Para do Nero. Well, it's really wonderful to be here. My name is Misha, and Angie and I have known each other a long time. My Dharma transmission teacher is Les Kay, and Angie and Les, of course, first practiced together with Koban Shingo Roshi. Les, of course, is much more of a Suzuki Roshi lineage student. But I actually am of dual lineage because my tea teacher, Peg, was a student of Koban Shingo Roshi. And I pretty much studied as much with Peg as I ever did with Les, although it took me a long time to understand what an important teacher she had been for me. I think sometimes you think one person is your teacher, only to discover later that the person that actually has the most influence on you is someone you just thought of as a very dear friend. So, at the end of last year, my husband and I were able to go on a very long trip. For the first time probably in his adult life, he was given a paid one-month sabbatical leave from his company. And so I decided to take some time off as well. And we went to New Zealand for almost an entire month. This is a trip we've been wanting to go on for a very long time. But because it's so far away, just going for a week or two didn't seem like a great idea. So I was very excited, and it took us almost the whole year to plan for this trip, very complicated being away. And I began to think of it in terms of a pilgrimage. It was more than just a vacation, in a sense. And I didn't want to always be viewing it from the outside. And of course, the difficulty with traveling for a month to a place like New Zealand, where on the one hand it's going to be warm in some places, but then you're going to be near glaciers in other places, is how to pack. And one of the biggest difficulties, and I'm sure you all have this problem, is what books to take. And it turns out I took a very sort of odd selection, considering where I was going. I think I probably should have chosen books on New Zealand, but I didn't. The book I started with is something I'm going to quote from tonight. It's called Shantaram. And while it says on the front that it's a novel, actually a good part of it is autobiographical. And it takes place in Bombay, in very hot climate, and explores the very seedy side of Mumbai, sort of the Indian mafia, of which this person, who is Australian, takes part. And he also is on a pilgrimage. The other book that I read at the other end of the trip was that book about the Uruguayan rugby team that crashed in the Andes and were freezing to death for 72 days and ended up cannibalizing other people who had died. And so these are the books that, you know, on the outside I'm in New Zealand, but on the inside, you know, it was a very different experience. But they all have something to do with what I wanted to talk about tonight. It starts with the teaching koan from the Book of Serenity, case number 20. Daizang asked Paizan, "Where are you going?" That's Fayan, sorry. And Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." And Daizang said, "Well, what is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fayan says, "I don't know." Daizang nods and says, not knowing is most wisdom." Now the interesting thing is, this teaching story, I've heard it many times in the past, but it came to my attention again after I got back from my trip, because it was the little quote that San Francisco Zen Center put on their annual fundraising, which I didn't get until I got back. I thought, yes, that's exactly it. What is the purpose of pilgrimage? Bayan could have answered a lot of things. He could have said, oh, I want a new perspective. I want to get to know another culture, maybe develop a little more tolerance for people who are different than myself. I'm bored here at the monastery and want to go do something else. I'm young and I'd like to get out and meet a few new people. There are lots of things he could have said. But this tells me a lot about his practice. He says, I don't know. Very honest, very sincere. Not knowing is most beautiful. But that made me think about that word, intimacy. In our culture, intimacy is often a relationship between two people. Man and woman, man and woman, There's something very close, often sexual, but not necessarily. But that's when you say that word in public, intimacy, it's implying certain things. That's not what's being said. Intimacy is no separation. It is the definition of emptiness. So when we go with not knowing, then what we're really offering is the opportunity for everything to arise. Everything can be known. As Suzuki Roshi once said, I have to paraphrase this, in the mind of the expert, and there are few possibilities, but in the mind of the beginner, there are many possibilities. Again, I don't know. So this intimacy of no separation means that at least you have some understanding that everything, good, bad, indifferent, is your life. It is actually enlightenment itself. And even when you're on vacation, you have lots of ups and downs. And I think we have this idea that when we're going to have a vacation, or we're going to take a break, or whatever we want to call it, everything's going to be wonderful. And the fact is, it isn't always. Why is that? Oh, I see. It's because I take myself with me. And that's always where we get into trouble, is when our self is there, bringing all of its difficulties along. You never get to leave yourself behind. So, the way to work with that is to become completely intimate with this one here. There's another story in which the I don't know plays a very important part. I'm sure you know this story too. When the first Chinese patriarch, Bodhidharma, goes to meet the emperor. First thing he tells him, the emperor starts telling him all the wonderful things he's done, and, I've built temples, and I've supported all these monks, and so, what merit is there to do all these things? And Bodhidharma says, none. Pretty brave. For this monk to come in and tell the emperor, well, it's all nice stuff, but hey, no merit. Fortunately, the emperor is a pretty open-minded guy, apparently. And so he says to him, well, okay, so what is true merit? Because pretty much Bodhidharma says, well, there is such a thing as merit, but that isn't it. So when he asks about true merit, Bodhidharma says, oh, that is pure knowing, wonderful and perfect intimacy. But then the emperor, who is actually a pretty wise man, says, all right, what is the sacred truth's first principle? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness. So But finally the emperor says, who is this that faces me? Duryodhana says, I don't know. So in the first one, you have the master asking, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? And the monk saying, I don't know. In the second, you actually have someone being asked, who is this one? And saying, I don't know. Both absolutely, fundamentally honest answers. So I remember one time early in my years with my teacher Les, going into Dokusan, and him asking me something in response to something I said. And I said, I don't know. And he looked at me and said, your I don't know is not the same as your What is the difference? The difference was I was trying to be clever. It was not honest. It was mimicry. Oh, that's what the great master said. I don't know. So what is this intimacy? What is it made of? Why is it important to us as practitioners? So, in this book, Shantaram, it's essentially a book about redemption, personal salvation. And in the very beginning, what you find out, this part is all true, is that this man was a heroin addict. And to support his habit, he sold drugs and was eventually arrested for it in Australia. His wife divorced him. His child was taken from him. His family could not see him anymore. And when he was put in prison in Australia, apparently he was treated very badly. He was beaten often and cruelly. He was put into isolation a lot. And so eventually he figured out how to escape. And as he said, it was, as they say in the movies, in broad daylight. He was a very clever man. And he fled to New Zealand, which was the only part that had to do with where I was on vacation. From New Zealand, he managed to get to Bombay. And within a very short period of time, everything that he owned that was with him, including his false passport, was stolen. And as when he had first arrived, he had seen the slums from a distance going by in the bus, and was thinking, oh, it's awful, it's terrible, these poor people. Well, it turns out that before all of his things were stolen, he was approached by a man named Prabhakar, or Prabhu for short, who becomes his guide. And he and Prabhu get along really well, up until the day that all of his things get stolen and now he has no more money. And Prabhu takes him to his home in the slums and helps him set up his own home there. And he comes to find out that what he saw from a distance had nothing to do with the reality of the people, who were completely kind and generous and loving and took him in. Well, the important part for you to know is that at one point, Prabhu takes this man, whose name is Gregory Roberts. He comes up with a new name for himself, because of course he's got a false passport, so he calls himself Lin. So he takes Lin Baba to his family village. And Prabhu's family just totally folds him in, embraces him. They feed him, they clothe him, he stays as their guest. At some point, the river is about to rise, it's that time of year of monsoon, and there's a game they play of sticks. And the sticks, they put the sticks along the riverbed, and whoever guesses how far the river is going to come out of its bed wins the game, eventually. But here is what he says. I was thinking about another kind of river. one that runs through every one of us, no matter where we come from, all over the world. It's the river of the heart and the heart's desire. It's the pure, essential truth of what each one of us is and can achieve. All my life, I've been a fighter. I was always ready, too ready, to fight for what I loved and against what I deplored. In the end, I became the expression of that fight, and my real nature was concealed behind a mask of menace and hostility. The message of my face and my body's movement was, like that of a lot of other hard men, don't fuck with me. In the end, I became so good at expressing the sentiment that the whole of my life became the message. It didn't work in the village. No one could read my body language. They knew no other foreigners and had no point of reference. If I was grim or even stern, they laughed and patted me encouragingly on the back. They took me as a peaceful man, no matter what expression I wore. I was a joker, someone who worked hard, played the fool for the children, sang with them, danced with them, and laughed with an open heart. I was given the chance to reinvent myself, to follow that river within, and become the man I'd always wanted to be. Prabhu's mother had told me that she'd called a meeting of the women in the village. She'd decided to give me a new name, a Maharashtrian name like her own. And because they judged my nature to be blessed with peaceful happiness, Rukmabai concluded, the women had agreed with her choice for my first name. It was Shantala, which means man of peace, or man of God's peace. I don't know if they found that name in the heart of the man they believed me to be, or if they planted it there, like a wishing tree, to bloom and grow. Whatever the case, whether they discovered that peace or created it, the truth is that the man I am was born in those moments. The better man that slowly and much too late I began to be. I remember when I read this, I was really struck by it. I thought, isn't this the problem for all of us? Who are we really? Are we the constructed self, constructed by ourselves and constructed by others? Or is there a non-constructed self that may more truly be who we are? What I think in our practice we would call our true nature. Dogen calls it unconstructiveness in stillness, the meditation mind. This man, all his life, had been a fighter. He'd been one of those guys that if you saw walking down the street, you'd probably walk to the other side because he'd be kind of scared. And because he believed it of himself and that others believed it of him, there was no room to move. But here he is all of a sudden in a situation where a group of people know nothing about him other than the way he is interacting with them at that moment, the way he interacts with their children. They can't even do something simple like read his body the way we can. Americans sort of know what Americans do. New Zealanders know what New Zealanders do. The British, you know, have a little bit of a stiff upper lip. The Americans are always smiling. You know? We know how to read each other's body language, but suddenly here he is. They don't know how to do it. And so their assumption is that he is a good man. And in that moment, he gets to reinvent himself. Or, in a way, what would actually be more accurate from the point of view of practice, de-invent himself. That is the nature of no self. There's the self that is constructive, and it starts right from the very get-go. But practice, our practice, asks us to come to each moment, each person, and each situation completely fresh, completely new each time. It's very difficult to do. When, especially interacting with people we know well, chances are good we're going to come to that interaction pretty much the way we left it the last time we were with them, especially family. And you find that even if you do start to change a little, family actually doesn't want you to change too much, because then you don't fit in that category and role that you've always had. But even if we can't come completely fresh, do we discover the peace and the love, the goodness in each other and each situation? Or can we actually plant it there? Even if the person is a very difficult person, maybe deep inside they're just like this man. So we can either believe that, or we can try to plant that seed and allow emptiness, no separation, to arise. So as I was cogitating about all of this intimacy, this coming fresh to each moment, I happened to find this poem by Rumi, and it's exactly what Bodhidharma and Fayan said. So here's the poem. All day long I think about it, then at night I say it. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere, I'm sure of that, and I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in this aviary. The day is coming when I fly off, but who is it now in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I could break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. This is the same thing as I don't know. Wonderful. We ask ourselves these questions. All day long we think about it. In some form or other. But we don't know. So in meditation, when we first start to practice, there's a lot of blah, 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 blah going on. And maybe once in a while there's a silent moment, and then blah, 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 blah. But the longer we practice, the easier it is to start letting the blah, blah, blah go away and allow more of that silent to replace it. But in that silence, it arises. So our meditation practice has this wonderful aspect of self-reflection. Where do I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? Who is this one that speaks these words? Who looks out with these eyes? If we're truly honest with ourselves, if we're curious, if we investigate, what arises is this mind of impermanence that is always changing. That there's no such thing as nisha, some permanent abiding sense. Just when you think you've got your finger on it, it changes. Like chasing a dream after you wake up, and you want to remember the dream, and the more you try, it goes away. This impermanent nature reveals our yourself. This is the meaning, actually, of Dai Zhang's comment. Not knowing is most intimate. If I said I knew who this one here was, then really what it's saying is I haven't looked deeply enough. I'm not being completely honest and scrupulous enough to realize that no matter what I say, it's not exactly it. It's like the problem you have defining something like enlightenment, or Buddha nature, or true mind. All of those things you can infer, you can point at them, but it's not it. We humans have to use language. And even when you have an experience of no separation, the sooner you try to talk about it, you're separate from it again. So this intimacy, this not knowing is most intimate, is actually about being comfortable with not knowing. So I understand that you have been studying the Xing Shen Ming, and so has my group. And one of my favorite lines in the whole poem is the anxiety about non-perfection. Because it seems to me that the biggest difficulty for us is that we think we should know. That in a perfect world, I would know everything. And as a teacher of young children, what I find is children who are very anxious think that they already need to know something before you're even teaching it to them. And I find that there are even adults who have this difficulty. And they are very hard on themselves when they don't know something. And really, what Dai Zhang is asking us, what Bodhidharma is telling us is, it's actually great to not know. Be at ease in your not knowing. The greatest physicists in the world, what they come back and say is, there is so much we don't know. We know these little things, and we've spent, you know, 1,000 years figuring them out, and there's so much to know and no way to know. So usually, as Rumi describes it, we are stuck in this prison for drunks. I mean, imagine prison for drunks, a very uncomfortable place to be, rowdy, violent people. And we are captive there either by our own beliefs about ourselves or by other people's beliefs about us. So it took me a long time to realize that within my own family, a belief that I had about myself, which was corroborated all the time in my family, was that I was the peacemaker. I was the nice one. I was the one who everybody else would go to tell about what the other sibling or mother or father wasn't doing right. Until the day that I got really angry with my sister. Now, usually if you get angry with a sibling and you have words, you know, it's not great, you make up, you apologize. She was not going to let me apologize. She was so upset. And looking back at it now, I realize it's because I stepped out of my role as peacemaker and stepped into another role which was completely unfamiliar, of somebody getting angry. And that was not acceptable. So it took a long, long time of trying to get our relationship back together again. So, if we could just taste one sip of an answer about who this one really is, outside of all those constructions, because there are things that we believe about ourselves that often we don't even know we believe. So Suzuki Roshi often would say, not always self. And this was to remind us, whatever you say, you have to ask, really? Are you sure? Because not always so. Yeah, maybe a lot of times I'm a peacemaker, a lot of times I'm a mediator, a lot of times I bring people together to have conversation, but that's not who I am. That's a quality. What is this prison that we get stuck in? It's the prison of delusion. You know, we have our three poisons of aversion and desire and delusion, or ignorance. And the first two are always leading to the third one. We're always wanting something or not wanting something, even if it's small. Oh, my tea is too hot. Oh, my tea is too cold. Nothing is ever just right for us. Because of number three, our belief is that there's me, and then there's everything else. It's very difficult not to be self-referential, not to be the center of the universe. Each person is the center of their own universe, in their mind. But this is the fundamental delusion, because we are actually all connected to everything. There is no center. So this prison, the thing that keeps us always in suffering, is our feeling of separation, our feeling of alienation, which is rampant in this culture. We don't find it so much in New Zealand, I discovered, and part of the reason is they have a lot fewer people. They have a country the size of California, but there are only 4 million people in it. And it turns out that the more people you have, often the more alienated you feel. It's an odd paradox. It's like there's so many people, there's no way to relate to them anymore. When there's very few people, you have to relate because those are the people you rely upon. But we are stuck in this belief of this self with a capital S, of being separate. And the problem is, it looks like we are. This body looks separate from all of you. This is partly to do with very gross senses we can't see all the atoms in the room, or we can see just how fuzzy everything is and blending with everything else. One of the ways I think about it often is, at what point does the air in the room coming into here become me? And at what point does the air that I am expelling become just air in the room until it enters you? Because we're all breathing the same air. But when you think of it in terms of molecules, you know, those molecules go in and they go into my bloodstream. They move around. Is that me? Because at some point they go back out. Maybe not exactly the same ones at the same time, but it's all in and out. So this is why when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, he had this big argument with Mara during the three watches of the night. Mara was tempting him and talking to him. But finally he sees through everything and says to him, "You know, jailer, I see you now, and you will never imprison me again." What he saw was his connection to everything. So, of course, then that explains when he says, at this moment, everything is enlightened with me. It sounds like a tremendously egocentric thing to say, but in fact, it's the opposite. He was not saying it from the point of view of being the center of the universe. He was, in fact, connected to everything and everything connected to him. And he saw it very clearly. And when you see that, then you realize just how difficult it is to say who this one here is. Because in a sense, right now, each one of us is connected, even though I really don't know any of you in that sort of conventional way. But we are sharing this space and breathing this air, and you are hearing the sound of my voice, and I am seeing all of you. So Suzuki Roshi said in one of his books on the Sayadaw lectures, he said, "Buddha's way is the study and teaching of human nature, including how foolish we are, what kinds of desires we have, our preferences and tendencies." I use that preference word again from the Shenzhen Ming. He said, "Without sticking to something, I try to remember to use the expression liable to. We are liable to, or we have a tendency to do something." So if you remember our friend from the beginning, Lin Baba, his tendency was to be violent. His tendency when faced with difficulty was to fight. And that tendency had always been corroborated, supported by his friends, his family. But what Suzuki Roshi is trying to say here is that our tendencies are not a permanent part of the self. They're just what we're liable to do. And without the benefit of a practice of self-reflection, what we start to habitually do. These tendencies are like seeds. Now, they may have a biological component. I'm perfectly willing to accept that. I know, for instance, in the last many years, they've actually identified that these individuals who do very extreme sports, very, very dangerous, risky things, sometimes actually have an extra gene that makes them want to do really crazy, risky things. But you could have that gene and still not be that person if it was not nurtured. Mm-hmm. But the thing to remember is we all have tendencies, and many of them probably start in biological ways, our genes. But causes and condition either water those seeds or don't and let them die out. If they are watered, they become habitual. So Thich Nhat Hanh's, or, you know, the good seeds versus the bad seeds. Well, all right, so in my world, my tendency is impatience, which becomes anger. In looking back at my family, I see exactly where it comes from. Now, maybe there's a little biological component there, and all the women in my family back through, you know, many generations have this, I don't know. But it is true that I saw it being the example of it in the women in my family. I carried it on myself until I started doing serious practice. I thought it was who I was. Not so. It's a seed that had been watered. But if we believe this about ourselves, if we believe I am an angry person, I am an impatient person, I am a jealous person, I am a wicked person, whatever. If we believe that is who we are, then we will also believe that change is not possible. That who we are is beyond our control. Who we are is permanent. But if we're lucky, we have an experience like Shantaram, where somebody doesn't know anything about your tendencies, where somebody greets you absolutely, completely right here, right now, in this moment, and does not judge. They take who you are fresh in that moment and start there, so that you can de-invent yourself. Time and again, when I was at Zen Center last year, hearing people talking about Suzuki Roshi, what came up was how accepted they felt by him. How no matter what they thought of themselves or what other people thought of them, that Suzuki Roshi always met them right where they were, with no judgment. That is tremendously powerful. It's just like Shantaram said. You know, he didn't know. Did they find that name in the heart of the man they believed me to be? Or did they plant it there? But either way, it's incredibly powerful. We can use our meditation to see our tendencies. We may always have these tendencies. I'm probably always going to be somewhat impatient, and I'm always probably going to suffer from anger. But I know it about myself. I work with it all the time. I can watch it arise, and I can let it go so much more easily. Rumi understands the nature of this delusion, of the separation from ourself. That's really what the separation is. It's from the self from the self. Because there's this concretized self that we believe is us. And then there's actually who we are. And that's who we're trying to get to know. Rumi says, I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. We don't come here of our own accord. We arrive on this river. And the way Suzuki Roshi described it, you know, there's this river that we are all part of. And then suddenly there's this waterfall. And in the waterfall, all the drops are suddenly separate, making that journey, that pilgrimage, from top to bottom, along. bumping into each other along the way, making little connections, but fundamentally having to make that journey from the top to the bottom, that is what we call life. To rejoin the river of being at the bottom. Whoever or whatever brought me here will have to take me home. Home is the place where I don't know feels perfectly at ease. So I don't know what we normally do at this point.
Well, we do normally have questions, and then we have a 1 minute sit. But
what's the timing here?
Yeah, we might have time for a few short questions.
Yeah. So, and it can be about anything. It doesn't have to be about what I was talking about. If anyone has a question or a comment, some experience you've had of not knowing.
The book that you described so well, I have a lot of questions, but so is that fiction or nonfiction?
Well, it's interesting because it says a novel on the front, but he gives in the introduction, he tells you about his life right up front, about being a heroin addict and all of that. And so actually what I think it is a fictionalized autobiography. And he is talking about himself. And there are probably places in here where he's added things in order to get a point across. There's a character who becomes like a father figure for him, who's one of the heads of the mafia. In India, but a very wise man in that he has a very strong morality. So the kinds of things he does to make money, he does not do what most people do. He will not be involved with drugs and anything that has that kind of harmful quality to it. But he uses that character to talk about the nature of good and evil. And, you know, at one point, this character, Kadarbhai, says, there are no good men or bad men. There are only good acts and bad acts. And that's why I say, in a sense, it is a story about redemption, about the possibility of being seen as a bad person until the day that someone sees who you really are and meets you there, which is very different than what we're often doing. So it is called Shantaram, and the author's name is Gregory Roberts. I highly recommend it. It was fascinating, and there were many pages being bent down as I went along, but that one part especially, I remember just thinking at that moment, this is like a moment of enlightenment where suddenly you get to see the self completely new and fresh and without all the constructs that we're almost always creating.
Well, first he went through that loss of a lot of his external construct, yes, that's a good word.
Well, and all of the
his wallet.
Yeah, I mean, first he lost all of his human relationships, which is, that's part of going to jail. Then he lost all of his material wealth.
Yes.
And
opened it.
Right, starting from nothing. Only to discover that there were people there to support him. The, you know, like Prabhu, people he would never have counted on in a previous, in his previous life, who showed, you know, it's one of our, it's our practice of generosity, taking care of what's in front of us. That, that's what Prabhu and the other people in the slum really understood very well. And even though they had nothing, they shared their nothing with him. Really quite different often than our experience here, where people have lots and are very tight with it.
Yes. You talked about the deep intimacy of no separation, knowing the self, and also the deep intimacy of not knowing. And at first it seems different and kind of a paradox, but I think what you're saying is that they're really one, and they converge in emptiness and no self. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if there's a phrase that Gil Fonstall has used that I love, of, you know, how does it go? Knowing is independent from knowledge. So knowledge is who we think we are in that conventional sense. It's the concretized version, all the facts about me which I could lay out in detail, and then someone would think that they know me. But knowing, as you say, is actually about letting all of that go. And in that space, allowing what actually is to arise moment after moment. So the, you're right, the not knowing becomes the knowing. We're very afraid to not know, and so a lot of times we don't allow ourselves to open that space up. I think, in fact, you've probably all heard that poem about standing on a 100-foot pole and then jumping off. I think that's what it's about, that we're very afraid that if we jump off that 100-foot pole into not knowing, there's not going to be anything there to catch us. And, but in fact, when we finally allow it to happen, the whole universe is still waiting. It's quite wonderful. Because not knowing, it turns out, is much bigger than knowing. So, shall we sit together for a moment?